I was 8 years old in 69.
I forgot to push this button, so we're going to start with the music, and then we'll
walking toward
the lake on a country. They didn't get our thinking, so that's fine. So now we can be on this. Yeah.
There was something magic in that cool lake breeze, the way it stirred up the dust and whispered through the trees. It spoke in a way, and I knew that somebody cared. I'm gonna live by the land where my grandfather lived. Gonna walk the same path, breathe the same clean air, and I'll follow this road if it'll take me there. I can still feel the heat of those summer days, and how a day on the beach could make the hot go away. And when it was time to go home, I still wanted to stay. A train on the hillside would struggle by and spatter black smoke against a blue canvas sky. The sound of clattering wheels would fade and surely would die. I'm gonna live by the land where my grandfather lived. Gonna walk the same path, breathe the same clean air, and I'll follow this road if it'll take me there. Still makes me cry. I'm gonna live by the land where my grandfather lived. Gonna walk the same path, breathe the same clean air, and I'll follow this road if it'll take me there. I'm gonna live by the land where my grandfather lived. Gonna walk the same path, breathe the same clean air, and I'll follow this road if it'll take me there. If it'll take me there, take me there.
And that was Scott Adams and Blue Canvas Sky. And our guests on this hour are Liz and Dick Adams. And this is the second hour of a two-hour interview. And it's good to continue this and get to take on things a little different. So what are some of the stories that we didn't get around to, or the topics that we didn't get around to in that first hour that you'd like to take on?
Oh, I'll start with a story of transition with Logos Bookstore.
Uh-huh.
It's just interesting how these things happen. We were in the small.
And I'm gonna interrupt you because Logos closed 10 years ago.
2001.
So 13 years ago, it was a local institution for 30 or 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
30 years, and there's such a turnover of people here that many wouldn't know it, but the majority of people would remember Logos. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's just okay. Yeah.
We started out in a small storefront next to Charjan's, which was at the corner of Tioga and State Street, mm-hmm. before the Commons came in.
Right.
And in 1978, the owner of the building sold it to another gentleman in town who had a poor reputation, let's put it that way. And this new owner of the building said he would double the rent, which we couldn't afford.
Right.
And so the question was, what do we do? Do we, at that point, the Commons had been built. And so I was saying, do we put a tent on the Commons? And about the same time, there was a store, the Sturm Brothers, which was a men's clothing store, which was originally a Penney's store. They had that store up for sale. And Dick started going over and talking with them about the store, and several times. And I would ask him, why are you doing that? We can't buy that building. And he said, well, I don't know. I just talking with him, finding out more. So that was kind of left. And it was summertime, and we used to get together with two other families. We kind of were a mini community. We did our mm-hmm. did things together, and we were at Glimmerglass Lake this time on a camping trip. And so we shared our concern with the friends there and said, you know, we need prayer. Well, what happened was one of those couples went back to the church we attended at that time and just said, Logos needs prayer. No details, just that mm-hmm. was it. And a doctor from the church came up to him afterwards and said, well, what's the problem? And he said, well, Logos is being kicked out of their present location. They're thinking about buying a building, but they don't have any money. Mm-hmm. So it turned out this doctor and this friend of ours put the down payment on the building. And with a land contract, which was very generous, and we moved into Sturm Brothers' building, and it was much too big a building for us. We were in this tiny mm-hmm. storefront, so Dick thought, what can I do with all this extra space? So the upstairs, the mezzanine and the upstairs, he rented out to craft peoples. Mm-hmm. So we had a number of different artisans mm-hmm, mm-hmm. who took on their businesses in Logos, mm-hmm. which worked out great. And then we took the main floor, and you added things like, well, we had cards and posters and toys and music, and eventually expanded into an art frame shop mm-hmm. upstairs. So it just developed. But it all started because of these two friends who were willing to invest in our lives at that point.
Right, right. That, too, is another story that we do not often tell. But when we let the word out that we are in crisis and don't know quite how to get out of it, we're not asking people to necessarily rescue us, but talk mm-hmm. about it. And once mm-hmm. you spend enough people start talking about it, people who have either ideas that are useful or resources that are useful mm-hmm. or both oftentimes come together. And one of the mm-hmm. beautiful powers of prayer isn't necessarily how it changes God, but how it changes our availability to each other. Mm-hmm. And so and that's a very powerful lesson. It's we get to know the reality in which we live when we pray openly what our concerns are. And you were surprised by the forthcoming resources.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And that's but you live out loud when you give people the permission to pray for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can remember one other time when Logos, it was, I think it must have been in the 70s, late 70s. It was a time when there was sort of a national economic collapse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think maybe it was an energy problem. But anyway, it was a financial time in the whole country where everything was down. You know, it was a recession.
During the Carter administration, probably. Just before the Reagan election.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. And we thought, what can we do? Because our sales had gone way down, and we weren't going to be able to make bills. And we decided to write a letter to all the churches in the Ithaca area just to say we need prayer.
Uh-huh.
And within a month's time, everything was back up to good sales, and things went well.
And what did that letter do?
Well, I think for one thing, it really pulled the whole community together, all these different churches, mm-hmm. and it was very, and I'm trying to think whether we sent to synagogues. I'm not positive, but it was kind of like all the churches in the area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think maybe there was a sense of community among Christians, at least.
Right.
That they helped support.
Right. And you're also, as a couple, you're an interesting, in terms of your relationship to the churches. You were one of the, I would say, one of the last organizations that related really well across the mainline Protestant and the evangelical, slightly more progressive mm-hmm. evangelical divide. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful thing to straddle. And many of it, I grew up in that space, so I'm comfortable in that
mm-hmm.
space.
Mm-hmm.
But the space has become filled with hate in this country,
mm-hmm.
as people begin to take off on each other, and yet you continued your store, kind of was able to reach out to lots of different people, and
mm-hmm.
that's very powerful.
Yeah.
And your letter, I would have imagined, went out to a broad, diverse group of
it
congregations.
Did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm seeing. I was here as an undergraduate.
Okay.
In those years, from 1976 to 1981,
okay.
That's when I first came to
You're
Cornell
that young?
On a full scholarship, but so I didn't have a lot of spare money for anything, but I
mm-hmm.
do, but yeah, no, I knew Ithaca and I knew of your store, largely through people who had come to Christianity in some of the communes and the places out of town. And they also related to your story.
I have a story about...
Yeah, this was...
Yay God community.
Yeah, God.
Yeah. Do we have time for it?
We have plenty of time. We have.
Okay.
Yeah.
This the Yay God community came up from Central Park in New York City,
mm-hmm.
and Gil was the leader, who named himself Freedom,
mm-hmm.
and I can't remember how many there were in the group. Do you?
I don't know how many there were.
Yeah.
As that group disbanded, some of them became carpenters, and I worked construction with them as they were moving into the main community.
Okay.
And there were people who were friends with them that I also got
mm-hmm.
to know.
Anyhow. Mm-hmm. Well, the Yay God group went through a time where Freedom said we're going to have silence. It was like for several days.
Mm-hmm.
So they all went into silence. And at the end of this period, it happened that there was, I think it was a gas man, came in to repair furnace and left a Christian tract in the bathroom. And Gil picked it up, read it, and thought, it was kind of like the four spiritual laws or something. I don't know what it was. But anyway, it was a Christian message. He read it and said, he thought that this is something that we should do. We should become Christians. So when they broke the silence, he announced it. Said, okay, now we're going to become Christians, you know. And
and this was a largely secular Jewish background group.
Maybe Eastern.
Yeah,
I'm not
influenced by Eastern.
I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
Uh, So they all so-called became Christians. And then at that point, I guess some of them were looking for things to do in the community. So Logos became the recipient of some of these people who would come in and would want to volunteer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of our favorite people was Banana Tree. Freedom named everybody when they came mm-hmm. into the commune. And Banana Tree had lost one leg in jumping on a train, didn't quite make it. So Banana Tree, a great young guy, would come in and volunteer and work at the bookstore. Mm-hmm. And he would sit in the back. This was when we were in our early store. Mm-hmm. He would sit in the back of the store sorting books or something, and he would put his leg, he would just kind of lean it wherever it was convenient out of the way. You know, and other people would come in and be a little alarmed by the scene that they saw.
Mm-hmm. Of a leg leaning on the books.
But, yeah, and a number of these people we had come out to our, he'd come and stay overnight at our house. There were several of them. There was Splendor and Let, mm-hmm. and I don't know.
Some
anyway,
of them, some of them
we
still
we got to know quite a few of them.
Yeah, and I know Welcome and
Splendor.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the Siegels, Becky and Barry Siegel.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. That was part of their spiritual.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, right. And they didn't all stay Christians. Some, like mm-hmm. Gil, went back to his Judaism. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure where the others. But once in a while, we'll see somebody from the community still in town.
And I've had three people. Two or three people from that commune on the show, and you can check it out at madeofclay.org.
Oh, that's great.
David Shalloway, who was Welcome, and Mitch Bobrow, whose name I do not remember in the
okay.
commune. But and maybe one other. But yeah, and I knew Phil Tomlinson, who was friends with people there, but not part of that. And Mark Spicer. It was Benchmark, I believe.
You probably know more about them than we do.
And I'll tell my story here.
Yeah.
Because part of this is a back and forth. As they were integrating back in with mainstream society, I worked construction with some of them, and I had a really hard time making the transition from rural poverty and a subsistence, or self-sufficient, to put it in more honorable terms, a farm in North Missouri where we raised everything we ate and whatnot. But we were, when my dad died, unable to do that because it took a lot of labor and we didn't have it anymore. Mm. So I came to Cornell on a full scholarship, but the culture shock was wild, and I was not prepared for the academics. Mm. And so after 2 years and then a fifth semester, I took a leave. And I did demolition work on the building on the corner of Eddy and Seneca Street that had a fire in 78. And then it was Mac Travis's first gut renovation.
Okay.
And these guys from the Yay God family were a number of the craftsmen on that particular job. And I got to know them. And later that next summer, I was working, and they took meditation breaks. We took a meditation time in the afternoon.
Okay.
And they taught me in this course, in a very short period of time, how to kind of achieve a deep meditative state. And I was really open to it. And I practiced that whole summer. And the effect on me is that all I have to do is straighten my spine, breathe deeply, and my whole body relaxes. Mm. And for 2-3 months, I meditated for an hour twice a day. And the effect on my body has been for another 36 years. That's how. 35 years.
Wow.
That's how long it was. So anyway,
that's exciting.
They taught me something that I hadn't learned growing up in a religious family.
Yeah.
But they opened me to then look back. And I remember seeing the old men on the town where I grew up who were born in the 1880s and 90s. They would sit on the street on these benches and talk to each other or be silent together. And they would have their hands in their laps with all five fingers touching each finger, the opposite finger. And that is a traditional meditative and calming pose in meditation. It's also a traditional Christian meditation posture. And I began to recover these things that they had done that in modernity and our rush to be scientists and whatnot, we abandoned in our religious practice. Mm-hmm. So it helped me to be open to these other things. So I learned how to pray. and to meditate from the Yegod family.
Yeah, kind of yeah. Anyway. I've been trying to learn how to meditate for a long, long time. I should have talked with them.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was my long, long digression. You brought some more music, and I'm going to suggest either Holy Now or Walk a Mile. Where do you want to go next? Climb every mountain, let there be peace on earth.
Maybe Walk a Mile.
Okay. And that's what's up on my screen.
I want to walk a mile in your shoes. I want to walk a mile in your shoes. I want to know what you're thinking, what you feel. So I really want to walk a mile in your shoes. I want to walk a mile in your shoes. I want to walk a mile in your shoes. I want to know what you're thinking, what you feel. So I really want to walk a mile in your shoes.
Remember the fight that we had. Why did we both have to lose? It's because we both walked away back instead of walking a mile in each other.
That was Vitamin L and Walk a Mile in Your Shoes. And our guests on this hour are Liz and Dick Adams. This is the Made of Clay Report, WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. So tell me, you in the songs that you picked for this show, why Walk a Mile?
We really liked the Vitamin L chorus. And in particular, that song was a lead song on an album, which I think just expresses one of our philosophies of the importance of knowing. When you get to know somebody, before you judge them, you see you have to go through some of the same experiences to really appreciate, to understand them, and so it seems like a real basic.
right. And I'm going to just unpack a little something that you said, because I think I appreciate the way you use the language, but not all people will. Before you judge them, you want to make sure you kind of taken into consideration their experience. And there's been a running away from judgment on some people's part in this culture, or there's been a much too quick embrace of judgment in this culture. We go from one extreme to the other, and what we need is to be able to say, this is what I see. And I may or may not be right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what you meant. You want to be careful about what you say that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a powerful insight that we need to make judgments, assessments, observations.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we know the world.
Yeah.
And we also need to be accountable to those things, because we are often wrong.
True.
Yeah, I mean, and it goes back to when you didn't want to get out at Worcester to look at the college, and you didn't, or when you delayed your first date because you had to deal with somebody you'd offered a date to before and they got sick, or the misinterpretation of the trip and your first kiss, or whatever. You know, these are all things that we just have to be upfront about and be honest with our truth, it is our truth. And I can't validate or invalidate your truth, and that's why I get in trouble, because some people want me to validate them, but that's not my role.
Yeah.
But at the same time, my role is to accept you, and then you will find what is valid or not valid. That's your journey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I need to say what I see, and I may well be wrong. And there are times when I may be right, and I may be wrong, and you can't tell me because you don't have a sense that you can challenge me. Or I may be right, and you can't accept it because it's too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Our lives are lived in this ambiguity of judgment. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to preach a sermon, but that's my elder hat.
That's your sermon.
Right
that's
on.
Your sermon for today.
That's good.
Yeah. So wow, yes, and that's that group came into being. That particular clip was from a concert that they did for their 20th anniversary in 2009.
That's great. Yeah. And by the way, the first place they ever performed was Logos Bookstore.
Oh, really?
They had brought in their first album, and I said, and I listened. I thought, this is great. So shortly after that, I said, How about doing a concert? Because we'd have different musical groups playing at different times. And Jan said, well, we've never done a public concert before. We've recorded it, but we've never, gone to do it. And he said, yeah, we'll try it.
Right. So, and that first album, were they adult singers, or had they brought the children in yet?
There were children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that was an upstairs of the mezzanine part of
Logos.
Logos.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I've always liked liked their music.
You guys spent a lot of time preparing for this show and reflecting on your lives and thinking about themes. And I've asked about a few of them, but I also, there's a lot of stuff that I didn't ask and haven't asked. And what would you like to take up next?
Oh, well, let's see. What do you want to do?
I think one of you just step up and start, and then we'll pitch in behind you.
The universe.
Yes?
We'd like to start the universe, and Liz knows just what to say.
Several years ago, I guess it was in 2008, Dick had gone to IC to listen to a professor, science professor at Binghamton, David Sloan Wilson, who was talking about the brain or something. Anyway,
Keep me still, be there.
I've heard of him. Yes.
At that point, Dick had found this author, Michael Dowd, who is an evolutionary Christian or...
Evolutionary biologist and Christian.
Yeah, Christian.
Right.
And so we'd really been reading his book and really liked what he said. And so Dick thought, gee, maybe I should check. He saw David Sloan Wilson's name in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, maybe I should check with him to see whether he thinks that Michael might come to Hector to speak at Hector Presbyterian. So he called up David Sloan Wilson, and he said, oh, I think he'd like that. He says, I'll give you his phone number. And he gave Dick Michael's phone number. And Michael answered the phone, which he was surprised. Mm-hmm. And Dick asked him if he would be willing to come speak to our congregation, and he said, sure. And he and his wife, Connie, have been on the road in the U.S. since, was it 2002? It's over 10 years.
Wow.
They have been traveling the U.S., and he sees himself as an evolutionary evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
And they stay in people's homes. He stayed twice in our home. And so he doesn't even ask him for money. He goes, this is his calling.
Right.
He was a UCC pastor for, I don't know, a decade maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then I think it was Thomas Berry who influenced him to become interested in the big history,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
the great story. And so he was going around talking to all kinds of audiences, trying to explain how the faith and the science can come together.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. That the Bible is not literal, it's metaphorical,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that the stories, what we're finding out from Hubble telescope about the universe starting 14.7 billion years ago, that's factual.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Bible is more metaphorical storytelling.
It's more about meaning.
Meaning, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And he would call that the Bible is night language and science is day language, and how the night and day language can come together.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his mission, and we just really got excited about the whole idea of, first of all, that we used to think that there was the earth and there was heaven, mm-hmm, and hell, and this gave a much more accurate and mind-expanding, mm-hmm, picture, mm-hmm, of the universe, that it goes back for so long, and that there are billions of stars, of galaxies, of supernovas,
right,
that there's so much more, and that if you looking at God, it really changes your view of God. God is not the guy up in the sky. God is something much greater, encompassing all of reality.
Right, yeah.
And I remember back to a book called J.B. Phillips called Your God is Too Small, and mm-hmm, I think, mm-hmm, that's what traditional Christianity has been teaching, that God is too small and that God is beyond.
Right, I think we've had a number of historical whiplashes, and that's a whiplash is a sudden movement that throws your neck out of joint, and the extreme rationalism, which tried to put God pervasive in the reality of the universe, but as kind of an impersonal, mm-hmm, entity, was one effort to try to make God bigger, but it also kind of neutered God. Took away emotion, took away physicality, took away all sorts of stuff. And the backlash reaction to that was a heavily personified version of God, for Christians in particular, mm-hmm, and an almost exclusive focus on Jesus and the writings of the Apostle Paul. And that was incredibly damaging, because it was incredibly limiting both to the questions that we would ask and to the ways in which we would try to address them. So what you're suggesting is kind of where I've come to live too, mm-hmm, in my own sense of spirituality and faith, and that what we need to do now, and this is because I'm not afraid of other religious traditions or afraid of other ways of making meaning, mm-hmm, we need to teach science very accurately as what is pretty hard fact, as well as what is speculative and interpretive. We need to be clear about both of those things, okay, but we also need our children and our adults to become fluent in the language of religions, the world's religions. which is how the how the world works and how it ought to be are two distinct but completely interpenetrating questions. Mm-hmm. And the ought to be is the religion side. Yeah. And we cannot live as human beings. It is our nature to do both. And we have to do both. Mm-hmm. And I have taught, Jewish and Christian and Muslim and Buddhist and Hindu and Native American practice in the public schools, because these are practices that if you're going to be a competent human being in a diverse world, mm-hmm. we need to know each other's practices.
Absolutely.
And I think that's
right.
Yeah.
Oh, I agree with
this
you.
This is the universe. It's all of the above and more.
Right, right. And I read recently a description about looking at what God is according to the world scheme.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that God is like the river at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And that these different faiths are like wells down to that river.
Mm-hmm.
And that we all possess some truth, mm-hmm. and we're here to listen to each other rather than fight each other.
Right, right, right. And we can have, well, yes. This is another thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately. If we assume... when you guys were coming of age in the 40s and 50s, really more in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
We were not allowed culturally on television to really deal with heavily conflictual issues. Mm. We had Lassie, and this was more in the 60s, but we had these shows that were very, they may be off color and humorous, but they were not about the core conflicts in life. We had just come out of a depression and a world war.
That's right. Yeah.
And we could not put conflict in perspective. And we went to the other extreme of really denying its validity and its place. But in the upshot of that denial is now we have an endless run of movies and television shows and entertainment devices that are about violence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they're crazy.
And it's totally distorted violence, and it's not about real conflict. And mm-hmm. what we've avoided in both extremes is how it's not peace on our terms, it's the peace that passes understanding, that mm-hmm. surpasses our ability to either name it or control it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to learn to live within the conflict. And that's where communication, as you just said, is so important. And where we want to know, we don't want to know to convert each other, or even come to the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because that right answer, we may grasp it for a moment, mm-hmm. or we may be right about some things and substantially wrong in ways that we won't discover mm-hmm. for generations.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think back in my early days in my faith, we felt like we had to convert people.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see that that's not our job.
Right.
No, but to try to understand each other and encourage each other to be the best we can be.
Right.
Now you've got to convert the churches.
Well,
but the thing is anything that's a matter of faith, a matter of hope and trust, or mm-hmm. what Bob Handy used to describe at Union Seminary as realistic optimism.
Mm-hmm.
His was a god of reality beyond human comprehension and control, much like mm-hmm. science, not totally compatible with science and religion. Anything that is a matter of faith has to be chosen. It cannot be coerced.
Mm-hmm.
And so... if conversion means to encourage people to make different choices or better choices,
mm-hmm.
we are all in the business of trying to convert one another. But if we expect to agree with each other, we're deluded. We're deluded. And we're deluded for two reasons, because when you try to get people to agree and a little bit of coercion or a little bit of enters in, then you disrespect their orneriness and their own self. But you also... most agreement at bottom is a papering over of differences, and it's collusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we live in all of our financial stuff are in this crisis in this country is that we'd allowed collusion at the top to undermine us. Agreement is almost always has collusive elements to it, unless the agreement withstands much more than the people who who made it. Mm. And then if it's tested in that way, we can see that there was something more there.
Yeah. You know what I think of? We haven't even brought up Living Hope Fellowship.
Right, which is a...
but I'm thinking that I remember when we decided to make decisions by consensus. And consensus is something where everybody has to be a part of that decision.
Yes, yes.
And if there's one person that's against it, then that does not go forward.
Right.
And I have a good example of that. Back in this was pre-LHF days, mm-hmm. when we were just called a worship group. Mm-hmm. And one of the people, there were 13...
LHF is Living Hope Fellowship.
Oh, sorry.
And Living Hope Fellowship came out of a worship group, and that worship group also spawned the founding of 10,000 Villages, which is also now One World Market. It's become that. Transitions all across the way. But you guys were at ground zero on all of these things.
Right, right. Yes. So one of the gentlemen in the group was, he was a grad student at Cornell in agriculture, back from Nepal. And he thought it would be a good thing if we brought a Laotian refugee over. And there were 13 of us, and so we're trying to figure out how we could do this. So anyway, it was brought up to the group. And everybody was for it except for one guy. And so that just stopped it right there at that mm-hmm. meeting.
At that moment, yeah.
Yeah. And what happened was three of the men decided to go visit this other man to find out, because he didn't explain why he was opposed to having this refugee come over. And so when they went to talk with him and they asked him, they just wanted to understand better what... you know, his reasoning, you know, they're not trying to come to convince him of anything. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, I'm a student. I don't have money to, I can't afford to give money to this refugee to come over. And they said, oh, well, is that your only problem? Well, yeah, I just don't feel like I could be supportive because I don't have the money. Mm-hmm. And they said, but you can be supportive in other ways. Oh, well, yeah, that would be fine. So then the next week, they all came back and said, we've talked this over, and this person said it's just perfectly fine, and he can come. So Kampo Somshan Mavong came over, and he didn't speak English very well, and we've helped him look for a job and, you know, different ones of us did different things. By the time he could speak English, we found out that he had a wife and five children in a refugee camp in Thailand, and he would love to have them come over too.
Right.
So
one thing leads to another.
I know, and so it ended up that a year later, Sisu and the five children arrived at the airport, Ithaca Airport, and we were there with Kampo, and when they saw each other the first time in 2 years.
Wow.
And I don't know how many Laotians live in Ithaca now, but they're quite a community.
And this was the first. These were the first.
Yeah.
And they're also behind both of the Taste of Thai restaurants.
Yeah.
They're behind?
Both of the Taste of Thai
restaurants.
That's right. Yes, Taste of Thai.
Yeah, yes.
Yes, matter of fact, one day we went into Taste of Thai, and one of the children were working there, and they recognized us, and they gave us the free meal.
It's not what you were looking for, but yeah,
that was nice.
No, but, you know, we have tremendous ties. One of the things that's absolutely incredible about Ithaca is that we are extremely local, and we're the most isolated major research university in the U.S. Mm-hmm. 4 hours, 4.5 hours from New York puts us further away than Penn State is from Philadelphia or Pittsburgh. And there are no others that are as isolated as we are.
Really?
And yet we are, and we're a small city. We're like 342 out of 306 metropolitan areas in the U.S. And we have these enormous ties around the world, in part because of people like you encouraging to bring in refugees. And in part from the universities. Now, the university doesn't fully appreciate how much of this has been a result of refugee movement as opposed to ties to the university. Mm-hmm. But we have both communities strongly represented, and one of the highest non-native English-speaking populations for a small county in the U.S.
That's great stuff.
It's great stuff. And you're behind, and you were behind part. This is Peter Mayer, Holy Now.
When I was a boy each week, on Sunday we would go to church and pay attention to the priest. He would read the holy word and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. And when I was in Sunday school, we would learn about the time Moses split the sea in two, and Jesus made the water wine. And I remember feeling sad, miracles don't happen still. Now I can't keep track, 'cause everything's a miracle. Everything, everything, everything's a miracle. Wine from water is not so small, better magic trick is that anything is here at all. So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, but finding where there isn't one. When holy water was rare at best, it barely wet my fingertips. Now I have to hold my breath, like I'm swimming in a sea of it. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down. But I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is holy now. Testament, that'd be very hard to say. See another new morning come, and say it's not a sacrament. I tell you that it can't be done. This morning outside I stood, saw a little red-winged bird shining like a burning bush and singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things have changed since then. Everything is holy now. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down. But I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is holy now.
And that that was Peter Mayer and Holy Now. And our guests on this hour have been Liz and Dick Adams. And this is the second hour of this show, doing it in two parts. Peter Mayer, Everything is Holy Now. What does that mean to you at this point in your lives? Everything is holy now.
To me, it means, well, for one thing, that my view of God has changed. Mm-hmm. What used to be a God who maybe like a puppet was pulling strings and trying to influence here on earth, to a way of looking at all of reality. Mm-hmm. That God is, I thought of it this morning,
sure.
Trying to explain God, the loving reality in which we live and move and have our being. Mm-hmm. That I see that God is involved in the universe, that everything has somehow the divine in it. Mm-hmm. And I guess you'd call it maybe panentheism or...
Not necessarily. You could. But what I hear you saying is that rather than God in a struggle with human beings to try to pull the strings and get things to work out particular mm-hmm. ways, God has given us this great, wondrous, loving space. And it's ours to do with it in ways that are good mm-hmm. or not good. And that's our role, is to love it, to embrace it. And sometimes we fail and we do miserably, but it will not change the fact that death happens. It will not change the fact that there are earthquakes and there are mm-hmm. seasons and there's violence. Mm-hmm. That is also rolled into God's loving presence. And what matters mm-hmm. is how we respond to it.
Mm. Well put.
Well, you just said it, and I just gave it back to you in a slightly different way. We are in the same page, I think, or very mm-hmm. similar places. Mm-hmm. It's time for us as a people to quit blaming God or reality for our inability or unwillingness mm-hmm. to face each other.
Mm-hmm.
Not to convert each other, just simply to face each mm-hmm. other as equal human beings.
Right. And I think we need to look at the environment as something sacred, mm-hmm. That humankind has been foolish in the way we have dealt with our mm-hmm. environment.
Mm-hmm. And sacred doesn't mean it's inviolable. We do things that will have negative consequences to mm-hmm. ourselves and others. Mm-hmm. It's still sacred.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sacred is not perfectionism.
Right.
And that's
right.
The early environmental movement kind of got tied up in that. Not, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you guys have a strong commitment to environmental issues, and you brought one with you that has to do with this proposed LPG gas storage facility and the abandoned mm-hmm. or the former salt mines that are throughout this area, but the ones in question are the ones near Watkins Glen.
Yes.
And
yes.
What is it that you want us to know about this issue? This is an issue you guys care deeply about.
Well, we're concerned about the LPG, the liquid petroleum gas storage in Watkins, because we see all the ramifications of having an industry come in and totally change the environment of that lake community. There's so many things that an accident mm-hmm. Could do to the water, which is the drinking water for 100,000 people. There's a problem of a fault close by, and we've heard that salt caverns have the most accidents of any kind of cavern where storage is or takes place.
We're also dealing with all the trucks and traffic that's apt to happen. I mean, can you imagine all the trucks going through Ithaca mm-hmm. for working on this? Mm-hmm. And Hector is kind of a country place, and Even our highway now, I can't believe how much traffic there is.
Right. There are issues. There are big issues in this region, and there are real reasons to go slowly, if at all. Mm-hmm. If at all. Mm-hmm. We cannot... Preserving culture is not putting it in a bottle and letting it stay, which was that was culture survival's old symbol, was an Amazon Indian sitting in a bottle, a jar with the lid on top. You can't do that. And Ithaca is... A third of the people who work in Ithaca full-time commute in from outside the county, and they only do that because there's not much happening outside the county, and also because we haven't built enough housing locally. We'd need 10,000 units for those 20,000 people to offset that, and that's the net, because, and there are probably about 5,000 who commute out. But we have a regional impact. We are not rural anymore, as much as we'd like to think of ourselves as rural. We are. We have not figured out how we're going to be responsible to the environment and to the people who depend upon it. Almost all of our schools are shrinking because young the area is becoming older and people aren't having as many children. We are. We have a lot of issues, but this is one to keep. You know, you're rooted in the environment.
Yeah, and the other thing is that one of the things is the winery. Businesses which have grown up around the lake, and that's like the major industry that which draws tourists, and along with that, tourists are coming to Hector and Watkins because it's a pristine, beautiful place. It's a quiet, it's still country.
Right. However, of the people who hold jobs, kind of conventional jobs, who live in Schuyler County. More of those people work in Tompkins County than anywhere else, including Schuyler County. That's the level of dominance. Right. And so there are a lot of people that are commuting 30 miles to make that trip, which if we had some development in Watkins that were sustainable at a decent pay level, would be a big improvement. And it would mean that they were also not so separated from their children. Because when you commute like that, it really affects the amount of time you can spend in kids' activities after schools and meetings and stuff like that. There are just lots of ramifications.
Yeah, and you wonder whether, I mean, it was a salt mine.
Yeah.
Why can't it be a salt mine again?
Is it played out, or what's happening? Yeah. What's happening? Mm-hmm. These are all, and asking the right questions. We need just to ask better questions and stick to them.
Right. And I think they have to, it's not only just local, but it really is the whole big picture of global climate change and just how these little things, letting methane into the air or, you know, carbon dioxide, it's the big picture as well as the small picture.
Yes, yeah, all at the same time.
Yeah.
All at the same time. And that captures, I think, your view of God. It's the big thing as well as all of the little things all at once.
Yeah.
So you wanted to close with Climb Every Mountain.
Oh, I just think it's a challenge not to turn down any possible experience that might enhance your life or enhance the benefit of mankind.
Humankind.
Yes. Your memory may be affected, but it's not affected that call. Yes, right. And I also want to note, because we also love kind of the obscure and the homemade, but we also love Broadway. And the big picture and the show tunes and stuff like this. And this is a show tune.
Yeah,
it's part of consumer culture. But it's not all bad. And that's one of the... I mean, it's not all good and it's not all bad. It's living with the reality that we're given. And thank you very much for sharing your lives with me this morning.
Thank you, Eric.
Climb every mountain. Search high and follow every byway, every path you know. Climb every mountain.
You've been listening to the Made of Clay Report. This is WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that's it for today.